This is Conquering Columbus.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Conquering Columbus podcast. This is Andy, show producer and editor. On today's episode, we've got a re-release. This episode is with Brad Martin, the founder and CEO of Focus CFO. They provide fractional CFO services to small and medium-sized businesses. Brad is incredibly knowledgeable, and I know for me, I learned a lot from this episode, and I hope you do as well. Enjoy.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Conquering Columbus podcast. This is your co-host, Mike, here, and we got Josh and me back in the booth again today. So, Josh, what's going on?
Not much. I like how you announced that we're back. We're always in the booth.
There's nobody else. You were by yourself last week.
For us. That is true. Actually, I didn't do it last week. We ran into some issues, travel complications, but we are both back.
Everyone's back. See, there you go. So we weren't always in the booth.
There we go.
But we're excited. We've got a great guest for everybody lined up today. Not much going on in Columbus, really, recently, is there?
Dude, as long as the trains are staying on the rails, I'm happy to be in Columbus. Everything else around us is...
I'm not even going to get into East Palestine. On that note, we're going straight to our guest. So joining us today is Brad Martin, founder of Focus CFO. And Focus CFO provides fractional chief financial officer support to small and medium-sized businesses that are not large enough to need a full-time CFO. Brad started Focus CFO in Columbus in 2001. And today, Focus CFO operates in 10 states. They have over 140 associates, and they are in the top five in the U.S. within the fractional CFO industry. Brad lives out in Granville with his wife, Michelle, and they have five grown children and three, almost four grandchildren. So congratulations on that, Brad. But welcome to Conquering Columbus. It's great to have you here.
Great to be here. Love what you guys are doing.
Yeah. Excited to talk to you, learn more. It's always funny how you kind of discover these companies being in what we do, right? That I never would have known we had one of the top fractional CFO groups in Columbus, but I'm excited today to talk to you about that and kind of how all this got started. One of the first places we always like to go, Brad, is just give us a little background on yourself, kind of share a little bit about your story and how you got to where you are today.
So I grew up in Ohio. My dad was a policeman, Ohio State Highway Patrolman. And so when I was a kid, we bounced around Southeast Ohio and ended up on the east side of Columbus when I was 16. I graduated from high school in Reynoldsburg. 1979, I met my wife in high school. We went away to college together. When I got out of college, I worked for a CPA firm for a couple of years. I thought that's what I wanted to do. After about 2 years, I knew it wasn't what I wanted to do. And went into industry as a finance and operations person where I worked for 15 years. I had a great run in industry. Was really fortunate with some great mentors. And then 18 years into my career, I jumped off the cliff and started Focus CFO.
Where did you do your studies? Where did you go to college at?
Undergraduate at American University in Washington, D.C., and then we were in Atlanta for a while, and I went through an executive MBA program at Georgia State.
What attracted you to finance?
That's a hard question. I mean, I hate to say that I originally got into accounting because my brother had taken a bookkeeping class in high school and told me it was easy. So that's why I took the first class, but I got into it and I liked it. I guess I thought the right way, but once I got out and really got into my working career, I think I was just more forward-looking than a traditional accountant was. I wasn't really happy with thinking about what happened last month or last year. It was more, where's the business going to go in the future? And that gravitated more into the CFO role as opposed to a traditional accountant or controller role.
You said you spent 18 years doing that, right? Inside of the same company or different companies?
No, I worked primarily, after I left public accounting, I worked primarily for two companies. Mm-hmm. I was really fortunate because both of them were $60, $70, $80 million of revenue when I started, but the entrepreneur that had started the company was still there. But in both cases, they had brought in a professional management team to actually scale the business. So not only did I get to see how a professional organization was run, and we were, you know, lots of IPOs and acquisitions and a lot of those things, but I got to interact with entrepreneurs and really get a feel for the passion that they had and what caused them to start their companies.
It's interesting because Mike said, what got you interested in finance? And then you answered, why I studied accounting. And one of the interesting significations for me is hearing from someone like yourself, especially with so much experience and breadth on where you divide the line between accounting and finance and how business owners look at that and identify that as well. So I'd love to hear your take on that topic.
Accounting tends to be historical oriented. So you think about a CPA and they're working on your tax return for last year. They're doing a financial audit for last year. You think about a controller, an accounting department, and they're closing the books. They're reporting what happened last month or last year. The CFO role tends to look the other direction to give people visibility into what we want to happen in the future and what steps we can take to actually make that go the way that we want.
I just want to double down on this real quick. And I don't even know if this will be helpful to our listeners. It'll be helpful to me though. And I kind of want you to bastardize my, is that the way you describe it? My take on this is like, so the way I think about this is you get money coming into the business and your balance sheet is kind of your platform of producing the cash flows that are then represented on the income statement. And then when what money starts to come out of the business that you're seeing predominantly represented on the income statement, you have to start allocating that capital in ways that's going to drive the most growth in the business. Is that how you would think about the value chain going through when it comes to cash with respect to operating a business, or do you think about it totally different?
CFOs tend to think about business from a cash standpoint, not so much from a sales standpoint and not so much from a net income standpoint, but from a cash flow standpoint. And what you find is that a lot of business owners, when they think about growing their business, if they're solely focused on what my sales are going to be, because you can sell something and not get paid for it for 30 days or 60 days or 90 days, mm-hmm. but you still have to pay your employees and you still have costs that you incur. So sometimes when you're growing a business, if you're not oriented around cash flow and what your cash position is going to be, just think what's in the bank or what you can mm-hmm. borrow, then you're going to basically run out of money. Mm-hmm. And so what the CFO is trying to do is trying to get inside the business owner's head and understand where they want the business to go and to create a financial roadmap. Think about like a financial planner that you would have personally. They're creating a financial roadmap for the business and how that capital is going to be allocated, what we're going to spend it on. Do we have enough capital? Is the business throwing off enough cash? Do we have to borrow cash? Do we have to get investors? Where's that cash going to come from? Mm-hmm. That's something that a lot of business owners struggle with, because when we start our businesses, all we think about is cash, because we're usually the first investor in our business as we put money in. And then what happens is, as the business gets more complicated and we get advisors that are telling us that we need to look at the accounting reports or we need to look at a balance sheet or an income statement, a lot of those don't really present the forward-looking cash forecast for the business. Mm-hmm. And so that's where a lot of business owners get trapped. They think cash, but a lot of the reporting that they have isn't geared to the way they think about the business.
Yeah. I mean, we've heard countless stories on this podcast about some of the early struggles of businesses, and cash flow comes up more often than I think most people would think. But what I'm curious about is kind of moving towards that decision point, right? 2001, you know, you probably could continue a successful career on the path you'd chosen, but you decide it's time to jump into entrepreneurship. Can you walk us through that decision-making process? What kind of triggered it in you? I mean, it sounds like you saw some entrepreneurs and got a chance to see what they were doing, but walk us through just everything that went into that decision and what those early days were like.
Towards the end of my corporate career, one of the things we had done is I'd worked for a company, we'd gone public and we raised $60 or $70 million. And I was actually on the team of people that got to go and find acquisitions. So we went public, we raised all this capital, and then we were out implementing a strategy where that we were going to find companies that would either allow us to sell our products and services into their customer base, or we could access their customer base and sell our products mm-hmm. to them. So we're going down that path, and we actually did, I think it was 17 acquisitions in 24 months. That's a lot. And during that period of time, I was traveling all the time. I was on the road, and most of the businesses that we acquired were between 2 and 20 million of sales. They were smaller businesses. The entrepreneur that had started the business was still there, and we were buying the company. And I was the one that got to have the conversation with the business owner. And I said, let me tell you how this is going to work. Pick a number. We are going to give you $3, $4, $5, $6, $8 million for your company. You're going to have to work with us for 3 or 4 years to actually get all of that. They call that an earnout. Mm-hmm. And I said, you're going to come into a public company and we're going to destroy your culture, because you have a very entrepreneurial culture. Mm-hmm. We have a very investor-oriented culture where that we are concerned about forecasts and quarterly earnings and all of those things. And the typical reaction that we got was, oh, that'd be great. I always wanted to work for a public company.
Right.
And then, you know, 3, 6, 9 months after the transaction was over, I'm still working with these entrepreneurs and I'm up in their office and they pull me in and 3 or 4 of them said to me, you were right. This isn't what I thought it was going to be. I wish I'd never sold my company. That was the line. And a couple of them actually said to me, because I was really involved in their business at this point. They said, if I could have worked with you, I probably wouldn't have sold.
Yeah.
And it wasn't me, Brad Martin. It was just me as a CFO, and I was bringing a skill set that they didn't have. Mm-hmm. So that's really where the seed was planted. And one point I had what Michael Gerber wrote a book called The E-Myth, and he called it an entrepreneurial seizure, mm-hmm. where that you go into work one day and you're a W-2 employee, and at the end of the day, you're an entrepreneur because something happened and you quit. And that's what I did, is I quit. Called my wife. She was home with five little kids. I said, hey, honey, guess what I just did? And away we went. But yeah. She was very supportive. And, you know, the market really didn't understand what CFO services were. Mm-hmm. We can drill down on that if you want. It was clearly a blue ocean strategy,
right,
to go out and bring this to the table.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like it was really like, because today, right, you see fractional everything, fractional CFO, fractional CRO, fractional CEO, fractional. It's popular now. But in 2001, concept wasn't really around quite yet. So I'm curious both on what the CFO function for you meant for these clients, but also how you educated the market on that and how you got people to understand. Because I have to imagine that somebody went, why would I need a fractional person?
What's interesting, because 2001, and the phrase that people were using was part-time, mm-hmm. part-time CFO, which actually had a negative connotation because it meant you weren't really invested in the business.
Sure.
But what we found was that nobody could really differentiate what a CFO did. And we talked about that, how that's forward-looking, mm-hmm. with what a CPA was doing or a controller was doing. So I had the hardest time back then trying to help people understand the difference between what a CPA was doing, mm-hmm. and what a CFO was doing. And a lot of people thought that just because something revolved around dollar signs, cash flow, forecasting, budgeting, that they would expect their CPA to be able to do that. The CPA model is just not conducive to that. They're working on tax returns and audits and things like that. Mm-hmm. So we literally had to go in and educate the market. And we chose to do that through referral sources, banks, mm-hmm. attorneys, people that had pools of clients that they could talk to, that if we educated one banker and they had 100 customers, they could begin to go out and educate their customers, mm-hmm. that way. That was easier than trying to go to the client direct. So that's what we did. And we just became a networking machine, a business development machine in Columbus.
And this kind of goes back to the question earlier, but what did you educate them on is the difference between a CPA versus what that CFO is doing or should be doing?
Well, and it goes back to the being forward-looking versus being historical. And there are great CPAs out there, and CPAs are just a tremendous resource for their client. But when you start talking to a banker, let's take a banker, for example. A banker is, when they lend money to a business, they're really interested in knowing whether the business can pay that back or not over time. Not about something that happened in the past, but whether something in the future would allow that business to continue to use that cash the right way. Mm-hmm. So that was the education process. We're talking about bringing budgeting and forecasting, that concept, to mm-hmm. small businesses, where that we could sit here inside of a business and say, okay, we know what you've done in the past. Now, Mr. and Mrs. Business Owner, help me understand where you want the business to go. I'm going to drive sales. I'm going to hire these people, or I'm going to buy this equipment. And we would take that and we would paint a financial picture going forward. And we would show people that that's what we were doing. Mm-hmm. And I remember one conversation where I had with a banker in town, and I was talking about putting together a team of CFOs. And he literally said, so you're going to be a CFO company. And he understood the concept, but there wasn't anybody around doing anything like that at the time.
And so I'm a business owner and I'm 10 million a year in revenue. And you ask me, where do I want to take the business? And, you know, maybe there's some that are more sophisticated than this, but I got to imagine on average, it's, I'd like to be at 20 million in revenue and make an exit in 5 years and continue growing the service lines that we already have. And so if that's my mindset, where does the idea of a CFO or finance related services come into play and add value throughout that path?
One of the things you have to look at is, how are you going to go from $10 million to $20 million? Because to grow, it actually takes cash. Mm-hmm. And again, that cash can come from an investor. That can be the business owner putting money in the business. They can raise money from the market. It can come from a bank, or it can come from the business. But when you start talking about growing a business from 10 to 20 million, one, how are we going to fund the growth? Mm-hmm. And the second one is, how are we going to focus on profitability? Because when people buy businesses, they don't buy revenue,
right?
They buy cash flow. And so if I'm solely focused on growing my revenue, you can have a $10 million business that makes $1 million, and you can have a $20 million business that makes $500,000. So which one's more valuable? And so how do you have planned, controlled growth in a way that maximizes the value of the business? And so the CFO is going to create that financial roadmap to show how to fund that growth. but it's also going to help the business owner understand the things they can do to de-risk their business so their business has more value at the back end because of some of the things that they've done. And that's a very complicated thing, and it's very counterintuitive for a lot of business owners.
So let's talk about the go-to-market strategy that you took on early on. I'm guessing, right, you take, like, clearly you have the knowledge, right? You have the requisite knowledge. You understand what you're looking to do, and you see the service you're looking to provide based on those folks you've talked to. But how do you get in front of those people? How do you start capturing those early customers, and how do you continue to scale from there?
Well, keep in mind that I'm a 40-year-old CFO when I start, and I'm not a business development person. And so the path that I chose to go down was heavy relationship building with people that I considered influencers with our ultimate customer, which was a lower middle market, small, medium-sized business. Now, I've talked to, over the years, I've literally talked to hundreds of people around the country that are either running what's known now as fractional CFO practices, or they actually want to start one. I'm yet to find a single person who did what I did, which is when I went into the market looking for clients, I also went into the market looking for CFOs. Mm-hmm. And so when I got my first client, I chose not to work it myself, and I never worked clients. And so I'm out in a professional services environment as a CFO doing nothing but business development full time. So that became a differentiator for us because that created scalability inside of our organization.
Sure.
And you think about attorneys and CPAs who are also professional service providers. Typically, when they start a practice like that, they're working the first handful of clients. And ultimately, you get trapped inside of doing the what we call the delivery work for the client. So that process of me going out and looking for clients every day, I mean, I would have 10, 15 meetings a week with people. And I would cold call bankers, CPAs, attorneys, business coaches, payroll companies, and anybody. And I would just talk to them. And the process was, do you have any clients that have a CFO? Do you understand what CFO services were? And I might have to talk to somebody five or six times before they really understood what it was. And because I was doing it full time, I could do that. Think about what would have happened if I picked up the first couple of clients. I worked it myself. And instead of having 15 meetings a week, I'm having two. We never would have gotten the scale that we're at now.
Did these CFOs already have full-time roles at other companies that they could pull this off, or they jumped off?
They were people that actually wanted to do what I was talking about, but they weren't wired to go out and get the customer. And still today, I mean, there's organizations that I'm part of that are nationwide that are full of very talented CFOs who love the idea of working with four or five different businesses a week. Mm-hmm. You know, you go here on Monday, here on Tuesday, here on Wednesday. But the thought of having to go get the client is just not what they want to do. And you guys are sales guys. You're wired a certain way.
Yeah, you got to want it. You got to get, that's something you can't force yourself into doing. It's because you won't enjoy it and you won't be able to put in the requisite time.
We have 30 people inside the organization that are business development folks. Mm-hmm. We call them area presidents. Half of them are entrepreneurs that have exited their business that want to help other business owners do the same thing. So we're out in the market constantly trying to connect with people and trying to meet business owners. But we have a lot of people who are CFOs who actually can learn a business development process that allows them to go out and be successful too. But we've got 140 people in the organization, 100 and some of them are CFOs that do the work, and 30 of them are the ones that bring it in.
You've been doing this for so long, I bet you have a very deep understanding on the first few minutes of a conversation with a business owner, who's going to be a fit for you versus who's not. And I'm curious what attributes those are that you've identified over the years.
When we get a chance to meet with a business owner, we're not talking about CFO services. We're trying to understand what the need is of the business owner. So we're asking questions.
Yeah. And sounds like selling.
And we're trying to identify what their goals are, what their struggles are, what their pain points are. And ultimately, a lot of those come back to financial issues, either because they've got some type of pressure. And pressure can come from sales going up or sales going down. Mm-hmm. If you're losing market share, you're losing sales, then there's pressure because you have usually more costs inside the business than you have revenue to cover. But most of our clients are going the other direction. They're actually growing and they're outstripping the cash. We talked about cash and cash flow. They're outstripping that. And so we're really just trying to understand what the issues are in the business. And sometimes when we meet with people, we're the right solution. Sometimes we're not. Mm-hmm. I mean, half the time when I meet with a business owner, or one of us meets with a business owner, we might find that what they really need is they just need a different banking relationship. They may need a business coach. They may need an advisory board. They may need a marketing person. They may need somebody to do the accounting.
Yeah.
But we do talk to business owners about what their goals are for the business. And if I'm an entrepreneur and I'm 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 years into my business, a really good CFO can look at their financials and have a really good feel for what they're worth. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, nobody has actually talked to that business owner about how to create a business that has sustainable, transferable value that somebody else wants to buy.
Yeah.
And so ultimately, the discussion, look, it starts off at pain points and it starts off with what's going on in your business. And we'll ask the question, if we were sitting here a year from now, you could have two things different in your business, what would they be? And they'll, mm-hmm. you know, they'll put their head back and say, gosh, if I could get more employees and have less turnover, and if I had a better relationship with my bank so I could borrow more money to fund the growth. Well, guess what the scope of our work is now? Right. How do we help them with those two things?
Yeah, I think it's interesting, right? You mentioned, you know, I think that's an area that you see a lot of people struggle when they go to transition the business to either new ownership or, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs out there struggle because they expect to hand off their business to their kids someday. And then when their kids don't want the business, right, it's hard to sell because they're such a big part of the value of the business. So I think that's super valuable things that, you know, one of the biggest things entrepreneurs should be considering is like, what's my exit strategy and how can I make sure that when we do make that transition, that the value of the business doesn't drop too much because I'm leaving. It's very, very difficult problem to solve when you're an entrepreneur.
It's completely counterintuitive too. I've had this conversation a number of times with people that their business is doing $5 or $6 or $8 million. They're making $400, $500, $600. I mean, it's a nice lifestyle business for them, but mm-hmm. and they ultimately think that what they're going to do is sell it for 1x revenue, but you peel it back and okay, so who does your sales? Well, I do all my sales.
Right.
Okay, well, who manages the operations group or the manufacturing process? Well, I'm out there all the time and I do it. And who takes care of finance? Well, I've got an office manager, but I'm involved. It's like, well, let me get this straight. So if I buy your company and you're making $500,000, I have to hire somebody to do sales. I have to hire somebody to run operations. And I have to hire somebody to look after the money. Now, all of a sudden, the business isn't making any money.
Right.
So how much are you going to pay for that business? And so that's what people don't really understand. And mm-hmm. the process of creating a business that has value, it's so counterintuitive because as entrepreneurs, the reason our business is successful to a certain level is because of us. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't create value because the business cannot be dependent upon us.
Yeah. That might actually be a really good opportunity to transition into a topic we had on our list, which is you actually brought in another person into your organization to lead the company, right? And even though you're the founder, right, you were leading it for a long time, but you made that decision to say, hey, I'm going to bring someone else in as well. And I believe they're the president today, right?
Correct.
So can you walk us through your thought process on that and why you did it and kind of what stood out to you about it?
First 10 years of the business, I was really involved. We were really just operating in Columbus and I did a lot of business development and I had CFOs that I got involved in that. And then we went to Cleveland mm-hmm. in 2011. It didn't work. And we went again in 2015 and we really spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to make the business work in another market where I wasn't there. And so I literally spent 6 or 7 or 8 years developing training, developing tools to allow us to go to another market and scale. So we actually got Cleveland to where we were doing $1.5 million in revenue, I think it was. So we were doing 2.5 in Columbus. We're doing $1.5 million in Cleveland. Again, it took 6 years to get to that point. I decided, let's go. And in 2018, we went to Pittsburgh, Cincinnati, Toledo, and Detroit all at the same time. And so we actually were able to get a presence in all those markets and begin to have success. But I was traveling to Pittsburgh. I was gone all the time. Mm-hmm. And so through that process of late 2018 and 19, I began to hit the wall personally. And look, the business was growing. We knew we had a model that worked. Mm-hmm. And one of my partners convinced me that we should implement EOS. If you're familiar with EOS, it's the Entrepreneur Operating System. Gino Wickman out of Detroit developed it. It's a book called Traction, but it's a mm-hmm. process to take entrepreneurial businesses and begin to transform them from one where the entrepreneur does everything to where you have a leadership team. And it was life-changing for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with it, but if you're not, it's really something that we all need to embrace because while it was the hardest thing I ever did.
Sure.
And there were times when we're doing 7 or 8 or 9 million. I mean, we had created something that really had value, mm-hmm. but I was so locked into the business and EOS actually allowed us to go through that process. And I was just really fortunate that through our networking, I found an individual in Cincinnati that he had grown a business to $40 million and sold it. And I was able to talk to him about joining us. And we went through that transition. And today I look back and it's so rewarding because what I do now is anything I want to do. I don't have that much to do with the day-to-day running of the business. but our business runs and it scales, and we're in 10 states now, and you know, we'll do $20 million in revenue this year. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a substantial number for a professional services firm. But that process of letting go of your mm-hmm. baby is yeah. just really, really challenging. But at the end of the day, the business isn't scalable unless you do it. And that's what's counterintuitive. Because mm-hmm. we think it's like, I built this, I've got to hang on, I can't let anything happen.
Yeah.
But until you do that, you're not going to be able to do the things that you want to do.
At a certain point, you become the bottleneck.
Without question.
Right. And that's the ceiling, because you can't be everywhere at once. And if you try and scale too much, then it doesn't work because you can't be there all the time.
Well, the other thing that happens is when you begin to get to that point, all the reasons that you started the business in the first place are gone. Mm-hmm. Because you started it because you were passionate about something. You wanted to be with customers. You wanted more control over your schedule. And you just really wanted to make a difference. But what happens is the business begins to trap you. And once you're trapped inside of your own business, it's just not any fun, because it's not like you're going to quit. You don't really have an escape hatch at that point. Right. You've got to figure out how you're going to go through that. Doug Tatum wrote a book called No Man's Land, mm-hmm. and he talks about businesses that reach a certain point and they get into this black hole
yeah.
that he called No Man's Land. And it's like, you have to figure out, am I going to drop back down below that? Again, you don't necessarily have anything that has sustainable transferable value. Or am I going to figure out how to get through the chasm
right.
and actually get to the other side?
And your idea of growing through entering new cities where, you know, I mean, weren't as much of a virtual world at that time, but it wasn't totally non-virtual. Why did you feel the need to have to pick certain cities and kind of act as a beachhead and grow that way rather than just saying, let's go out and find anybody in the country and start bringing them in across a variety of different areas?
In EOS, they call him your integrator. It's my president. He talks about how the fact that my idea of being able to manage the growth was I could get in my car and drive there in 3.5 hours. So that was actually the business plan. So we mm-hmm. drew that circle 3.5 hours around Columbus, which is how we got to Pittsburgh and Detroit and Cincinnati. What I wasn't willing to do at the time, because the business was so dependent upon me, is I wasn't willing to go outside of that circle mm-hmm. because I was afraid of losing control, because I just didn't have the organization, the infrastructure to be able to support it, because it was too dependent upon me. And then once I turned the keys over to our integrator, we've just begun to expand the circle. So we're now down in Nashville. We just opened in Richmond. We're in Charlotte. We're in Greensboro. We're talking to somebody in Las Vegas right now.
Vegas office wouldn't be bad.
No, well, if it's a direct flight and it's sunny yeah. and warm, we like those markets a lot.
I hear you.
Did you feel the need to have to be within that vicinity because you were still needing to go on site with these clients very often? Was it the Zoom essence of it wasn't embraced quite yet?
It wasn't so much the client, because we actually had a documented process that people in the markets could follow that we knew would allow us to get customers. It was recruiting of people. And so I actually was involved in all of the recruiting back then. And I actually met face to face with every single person
right.
that we interviewed, just as part of the process. We had a recruiter on staff. They would identify people, but I wasn't willing to take a chance on people unless I'd sat down and looked them in the eye. Mm-hmm. Once pandemic hits, we're all using Zoom. So
yeah, it's been weird.
it's way different. Yeah.
Hey, everybody. Mike here. We're going to take a quick break to talk about one of our sponsors, One Columbus. And we are very excited to partner with One Columbus. They really, really share the same vision as us here at the Conquering Columbus podcast, which is really building up the Columbus region to be one of the most prosperous regions in the United States. And One Columbus serves as the business location resource for companies across Central Ohio and around the world as those companies grow, innovate, and compete within the global economy. And they help us lead a regional growth strategy that develops and attracts the world's most competitive companies, grows a highly adaptive workforce, and prepares our communities for the future, inspiring innovation across the board. Their mission really is just ensuring the Columbus region is a vibrant place to build businesses and careers. So again, we really appreciate all of their support. You want to learn more about them, go check out their website, columbusregion.com. That's columbusregion.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll be right back into the episode.
Debt on businesses within the lower middle market. Like, one of the proudest things you'll hear a business owner say that's $5 million to $25 million year revenues, and we have no debt on our balance sheet. My take, probably a dumb one and short-sighted, is just like, I don't think that's necessarily a great thing, right? I mean, debt could be a very positive thing. So I'm curious, from your experiences in successful businesses, How do you look at that? Do you ever give it business owners advice on bringing debt into the business?
It depends on what you're going to use the debt for. If I have to buy equipment, if I'm a construction company and I have to buy equipment, debt is a wonderful tool to allow you to get that equipment because banks provide the cheapest, most effective and efficient source of capital anywhere. I mean, rates are up, but even still, 8% is just nothing compared to the cost of raising equity.
Yep.
So if I'm going to buy equipment, that's a great thing to finance. If I'm going to buy inventory, I've got a product I'm going to sell, that's a great thing to finance because there's a cash cycle. Think about retail. Mm-hmm. You buy the inventory, you keep it in the store for 60 days, you liquidate it. That cash cycle tends to be really short.
Yep.
Where people get into trouble is when they fund either losses or they fund overhead with debt. Because when the bank gives you a line of credit, it's supposed to go up and down during the year with seasonality. But if I go out and buy a piece of equipment with my line of credit, that's not what it was given to me for. I should get equipment financing to do that, which has a set term. Mm-hmm. It's got a different rate. The rate might be a little bit higher, but the bank expects you to pay that off over 7 years.
Right.
The line of credit is to buy, is to fund receivables and to buy inventory. Those are fine. But if I'm running a service business, you may find that you can operate that business very effectively without having a whole lot of debt. You might have bought a building or you might have some equipment, but those businesses tend to be able to fund cash flow internally. You might have a line of credit to help with some receivables, but you certainly don't have the debt load inside of that type of business as if you're running a manufacturing facility or a retailer.
Yeah. And so the difference for you is tying that debt directly to a quick and somewhat known return. Is that fair?
It's tying it to the, let's say, the life of the asset. Mm-hmm. So if that asset is inventory, it's going to turn relatively quickly. Right. If it's receivables, it should turn quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the banks have provisions that say if your customer owes you money, it's an accounts receivable, they'll let you borrow against that, but only until it's 90 days old.
Right.
At 90 days, they call that it's tainted. They actually don't want to lend you on that anymore because they're not sure it's going to be collected. Mm-hmm. What the bank loves to see is a business that uses a line of credit very effectively. It goes up and down during the year for seasonality. Mm-hmm. They're more than happy to continue to lend into that type of environment. But when you have a line of credit, you go out and you fund losses or buy equipment with it and you're never going to pay it down, it actually looks like that you can't pay it down. Mm-hmm. And that's where the banks are going to get really nervous.
So, I mean, big piece I think I'm taking from that is I want to make sure that my rate of return on that capital is greater than the cost of the capital. Otherwise, I'm going to be upside down on it to some extent.
I'd say that's fair. Think about the equipment. If I buy a piece of equipment, I'm going to use it in a construction company for 5 years. I'm going to pay it off over 5 years. I'm willing to pay that interest cost on it because when I put that equipment to use, I'm going to get a much higher return on that than I'm paying to the bank.
And so as I promised to be my last one. If I'm like, I'm a business owner, I got $1 million of cash flow in my business that I'm putting out and I want to go through this massive growth cycle and I've already understand the decisions on what assets I should purchase in order to make that growth happen and be successful. And I want to buy $2 million of assets. I do $1 million in cash. I do $1 million in debt. I get the interest shield from my taxes because I don't have to pay the tax and the interest of the debt. So I get that positive. Plus I go out and all of a sudden I got double the assets bringing me in, double the revenue, double the profits that are higher than my cost of capital. And my goal is then to pay that down over the term of the loan. Is that a strong strategy or do you think there's still even more that needs to go into it from a business owner's perspective before I make that decision to take on the debt and double what I was going to originally try to do?
I'd say there's more because the equipment is not the only thing that you're going to need to cash. You may need it for inventory. You may need it for startup expenses. If you're going to go to another region, you're certainly going to need it for receivables.
People that are going to run that equipment.
All of those things. So I think that's the holistic view to getting inside the business owner's head and saying, tell me exactly, Josh, what the growth plans are for the business. Mm-hmm. And then if I can get inside your head as a CFO and I can understand that, I'm always going to take historical financials because it gives me a benchmark and I can create that financial roadmap for you. I'm going to sit down with you and say, Josh, to get from where we are now to where you want to go, this is how much cash it's going to take. That's the financial model that we try to create. The sales is nice. The margin is nice. The overhead is nice. But at the end of the day, the line that we look for is how much cash does it take?
Yep.
And then it's a matter of sitting down and saying, how much cash do we have inside the business? How much cash will the bank lend us? Mm-hmm. How much capital do we have access to? And what's the best use of all of those? Mm-hmm. If you can borrow the money from the bank 18 months ago when you could borrow it 2 or 3%, you may not ever use your cash.
Sure.
You may hold on to your cash. You may choose as the business owner to take some of that out as part of your personal strategy to de-risk yourself from the business. Mm-hmm. But you know, when interest rates are 8%, you may say the best, because now you're looking at cost of capital, the best use of my cash is to use it inside the business, or at least some of it inside the business. But that holistic view allows you to paint the picture and then answer that question that you're asking. Because the question is complicated and has a lot of tenets to it. That's what the CFO would bring to the table.
Yeah. Well, Brad, I think that's a good place to kind of head towards some of our last questions of the show wrapping up here. One of them is, what do you think people should consider, founders, entrepreneurs, when they are looking at potentially bringing a CFO into their business or a fractional CFO?
I find that there's a point when the business owner, one of two things is happening. They are either personally spending too much time on the finance area. So whether this is the bank, whether it's trying to understand the accounting, whether it's trying to get whatever they need to run the business, they're spending too much of their own personal time, and they're usually not very good at it. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge opportunity cost issue there, because if I'm a business owner and I'm capable of bringing in $10,000 or $20,000 or $30,000 a month in new products or sales, and I'm spending 8 or 10 or 12 hours a week on this stuff that I really don't understand, mm-hmm. that's a trigger point.
Sure.
The other one is when the business owner doesn't have the right information to run their business. And we all do it. We base decisions intuitively. Mm-hmm. I did it. You guys do it. Everybody does it in their business. We make intuitive decisions. It's one thing to make an intuitive decision when you're doing $2 million of revenue that might cost you $50,000 if you're wrong. It's another one when you're doing $10 million and that intuitive decision miss could cost you $500,000.
Yeah.
So time is an issue and information is an issue. Mm-hmm. And the other one I'll just throw into there is that point about being trapped inside your business. Because right. as entrepreneurs, we had that passion when we started about something. And if what you're doing inside your business, what we're doing inside our business is not something that we enjoy and it's not fun and doesn't get back to that passion, that difference that we wanted to make, then it's just time to build a leadership team around you to allow you as the business owner to focus on the singular thing that you can do that you not only enjoy and you're good at, but it brings the most value mm-hmm. to the business.
Yeah.
In my organization, the thing that I'm at the beginning, it was bringing in clients. That's not scalable. Mm-hmm. So what I morphed to was I'm pretty good at developing training programs. So that's what EOS has helped me do. And mm-hmm. I mean, our training stuff is world-class. We can go into any market we want and open right now. We just have to have the right people.
Yeah.
And that's what I would encourage listeners to think about is if you're running your business, are you still having fun? Do you have the information? And are you able to have the financial tools to make decisions to make sure that you're continually adding value to your business? The hardest conversations I have with people are 68, 69 year old. They've been in the business for 30 or 40 years. You look at their financials and it's like, I hate to tell you this, but your business isn't worth anything. Mm-hmm. But if somebody had sat down with them 5 or 8 or 10 years before, we could have been able to put some tools in place and some resources and change that organization
yeah.
to where that business could be worth $4 or $5 million, which is what people need. Mm-hmm. They need that to be able to support their lifestyle once they stop working.
Yeah.
Kind of twist back into what I'm assuming was going to be Mike's next question. What are your goals for the future? I mean, you've been running it for a while. You've put yourself in a really nice position where the business is not dependent upon you and you can focus on what you enjoy. Where do you want to see things in the next 5 years, both for the business and for you personally?
I'm still involved on the leadership team. It's really from a strategic standpoint, but I watch what they do and I'm just incredibly impressed with what they do, how they do it, the ideas they have, how they collaborate together. The business will survive well beyond that. So I think from a business standpoint, the thing we're the most passionate about is finding CFOs who want to be part of a fractional team and creating an environment where they can do what they want, and then finding the business owners where that we can do something that's life-changing for them. And if you were to interview some of our clients, they would tell you what a difference it's made. So that's the thing that I'm the most proud of and the most passionate about is we're changing the lives of people, whether it's the CFOs and the people that are part of our organization or the clients that we have the privilege to work with. I just think I'm going to keep doing what I do. I mean, why would I not? It's like, there's no reason for us to sell the company. There's no reason for me to what do? I get up every morning, I go out and I talk to business owners, entrepreneurs. I'm not really trying to sell them at all. I'm just trying to coach them and help them. And maybe my experience as an entrepreneur is something that might be valuable to some people. And there's just no reason for me to not do that. I have just complete control over my schedule, and my leadership team has, they use me when they need me, and I let them do their thing by getting out of the way, and they're all way smarter than I am.
Yeah, another advantage of building a great team around you. I think that brings us to our last question here, Brad, which is centered around the theme here I'm going to show, unless, Josh, you got anything left?
Oh, I got, unless we want to start
for some,
pulling
some...
out actual balance sheets that I have questions
on. Right, yeah, there you go. I was waiting for you to jump off the top shelf with a balance sheet, but last question of the show is centered around the theme here on Conquering Columbus, which is live uncomfortably. So without telling you too much about why we chose that for a show about entrepreneurs, business owners, leaders here in Columbus, what do you think of when you hear it? How does it apply to your life and career?
I just go back to the early days, and you know, if I ever write a book, it's going to be called There's a Fine Line Between Being Really Smart and Really Stupid. Hmm. As entrepreneurs, we jump off the cliff. And I think every entrepreneur goes through a phase where they're, look, we start off and we're well capitalized and we make what we think are the right decisions. And it turns out that some of them aren't as good as we would hope. And the business just starts to get harder. And I think that's where that, was it uncomfortable for me? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have an out. I had a wife at home with five little kids who trusted me completely. And I just had to figure out how to make it work.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing that I love about entrepreneurs is they figure out how to make it work. And the thing I think that most entrepreneurs struggle with is the entrepreneur doesn't have to be good at everything, but they have to be good at something. And the trick is, find out what you're good at and do it really well and put people around you that can do the other things. And that's where we go from being really uncomfortable to actually being comfortable and allowing the business to really prosper.
That's a great answer. Brad, it's been great talking to you. Thanks so much for joining us on the show tonight and sharing your story and talking about Focus CFO.
Love what you guys are doing. Thanks for having me on.
And Conquerors, thanks so much for tuning in. That was Brad Martin with Focus CFO. If you want to learn more about Focus CFO, you can head on over to
FocusCFO.com.
FocusCFO.com. And again, thanks so much for tuning in. We appreciate all your support. If you want to hear more interviews just like this one, go ahead, hit that subscribe button on whatever podcast app you are listening on. We will talk to you next week.